Hey everyone, welcome to our DevOps Office Hours. It is June 28th, 2023. My name's Eric Osterman and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps teams conquer AWS using our rock solid AWS blueprints for Terraform. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, book a session with me directly by going to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll have a call to show how your team will succeed. For those of you new to the call, the format is informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of us joining through the podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls live every week. You can register for them by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/office hours. Our call today is recorded. We'll post a recording of the session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to support what we do and help us out, hit those like and subscribe buttons. That helps us gain wonderful members as everyone here today. So that said, let's go to announcements. All right, so a few things here. I had less time to prepare today, so I haven't gone as deep on any one of these. Also, that means I'm really curious to hear if anyone else has any testimonials or things to add to it. So I had the exciting opportunity today to meet one of our community members here in Houston. We went out for coffee this morning, and he turned me on to this tool called Changi. Changi seems like a GitOps friendly way of managing semantic versions and change logs through files that you commit. And then there's a CLI component of it that will help tie it all together, cut the release based on the types of changes, and merge some of the individual stub files that it creates into a release notes. Has anybody seen Changi before? Nope. All right. So let's see here. Next one is, next announcement was by Matt Gowie at MasterPoint. Matt, are you here today? He might not have been able to make it, but I thought it was great. Matt finally got a chance to write up their experience doing a POC with Crossplane. That can mean a couple of things. Like the worst is when you see a POC where it ends in success, very short, and it's like a recommendation to go to production. The next best thing is a POC that had a failure, but shows and or explains why specifically they ran into those problems. So their POC didn't work out that well for them, but I thought it was an interesting breakdown of some. It's kind of fair and balanced in the sense like, you know, why they went into this with great optimism, why conceptually they want this to succeed, but the reality of the POC and the challenges they faced along the way. Namely, a pretty obtuse YAML schema that required quite a lot of configuration to get right. Along with that came the learning curve and debug complexity, which was reduced to kubectl get events, which isn't maybe the best way to get started on the product. Also, like he points out, kubectl get events isn't going to scale with a busy cross-plane platform. I think it'll help you get your POC off the ground, but I don't know more than that. So other surprises were limited resource support. Some of the things that they wanted to be able to do, they couldn't yet achieve. And some challenges, perhaps integrating with some of the Terraform code that they already had, incidentally leveraging some Cloud Posse modules as well. So we'll share this link as well after. I think it's an interesting read for anybody who, as myself, has lots of FOMO with Crossplane, but from experience and battle scars, kind of practicing some temperance and not jumping on it. Also very curious if anyone has counter arguments to any of these things. I want to hear those as well. All right. Next announcement was something that was just in my LinkedIn feed, an end-to-end demo for EKS using Lattice and the new Lattice controller. Lattice is one of the most exciting announcements to come to AWS networking since the introduction of VPCs, in my mind. Lattice allows you to create an AWS-managed overlay network, mitigating the need for something like a transit gateway for certain use cases, and allowing you not to worry about, therefore, proper subnet allocations in all of your AWS accounts, because Lattice solves the issue of overlapping subnets in your accounts, because you don't actually need to peer them. Has anybody already been playing with Lattice? Or more than play? All right, that's a bummer, but yeah, we haven't yet had a chance to do a POC on this. I don't want to do that.
It's super, super early. It's the future, but so they use the Gateway API load balancer for Kubernetes, and their implementation is in alpha. There's a lot of opportunity there, and I agree, it is the future of networking on AWS, and they're doing a bunch of fascinating things, but I would play around with it, definitely. I wouldn't put it in production just yet. But okay, for folks that want to, let me find the repository. This is the, but for folks that have some time, yeah, play around with it. It's going to be awesome in the future, not now. Oh, I was linking to the AWS implementation of the Kubernetes Gateway API.
Yeah.
There are things missing. It was already Lattice itself is missing a couple of things, but it's maturing and it's growing super fast. And Kubernetes is actually pretty well supported. Like the ECS integration is being worked on. There's nothing available. It supports raw EC2 and Lambdas.
Can I just complain on one thing? I was so happy that they had this new repo for AWS controllers by AWS, I presume by AWS. And now they launched a new controller and it's not in the controller repository.
Because those controllers are for the ACK, which is their version, kind of is not really of crossplay.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And this couldn't be kind of considered like a Lattice?
Sense of AWS's naming. No, there's only pain there.
I guess pain, but I don't know. As an end user, it's Lattice. As an end user, it's S3. I don't know if I can distinguish. All right, sorry. End rant. So this is the controller that they're working on. That uses that Gateway API. I'm not familiar with the Gateway API. How familiar are you with it, Vlad, or anyone else?
It's basically Ingress version 3.
Oh. Huh.
Like so that's the easiest way to think of it.
Yeah. Could you say almost like this would encapsulate Ingress? So Ingress would be like some type underneath this? Or I guess, okay, so it encapsulates service, TCP route, HTTP route.
It's a higher level. Where you see this already is like Istio had Istio gateways, and they had their own custom resources for that.
Yeah.
And newer versions of Istio are using the Kubernetes native gateway function. So
that's cool. All right. Learn something new every day. So much bad news about LastPass is kind of boring to announce, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Yeah, another issue with LastPass. I guess a bunch of users were locked out due to MFA resets. Not sure what the underlying cause of that one was. Here was something I came across by accident, I believe. I mistyped dispatch.com. CO with dispatch.do and landed on this. So here is a interesting startup. I don't know anybody, you know, using Gmail. There's been probably a dozen or more startups around a native, better Gmail experience for like practicing inbox zero. Well, I guess Slack is now big enough that they're getting their own startup, building a better UI for Slack using the Slack APIs so you can stay on top of the information overload that is Slack and all the channels we're in. I haven't kicked the tires yet myself. Matt Calhoun on the team has, but he's out of the office today, so can't share his experience with it yet. Curious if anyone else is using it.
No, but I'd love to have one for WeCom.
WeCom.
It's the business version of WeChat.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Wait, you said you would love to have one for WeCom, yes. Or there is one. Okay.
No, gotcha. I would like to have this for WeCom.
Yeah. Well, I would love to have this. Oh, sorry, Ralph.
You know, I understand the sentiment why it was built.
Yeah. What I would love from my perspective is something. Oh, what was it called? I can't even remember what it was called. It's been 15 years ago since I used them. Trillion? Do you remember Trillion? Anyone? Like when there were all these different IRC servers and ICQ and MSN Messenger and Skype, it was such a pain in the ass to connect with everyone. So you had Trillion.
I remember that.
So for a while, speaking just personally, I've been on Slack now, you know, since inception basically, and forgot about all these other problems, HipChat and whatever were brief-lived things. But now we're back to it, and I need it for AWS Chime, I need it for MS Teams, I need it for Slack, and that would make my business communication a whole lot easier. I'd love to see somebody that could tie those together. Martin, are you talking to us? I don't know. You're muted.
Okay. I'm curious, how many of you think you've used more than 100 of these kinds of products?
More than 100 Slack?
So,
yeah, like chat platforms?
So I'm thinking I used to use Dialpad and PowWow and IRC. And so I once actually took the time to count together how many of these instant message products I've used personally for work and for work. And I got to over 100.
I have not enumerated them, but that sounds horrible. 100 ways that somebody can distract you, control your conscious mind, whatever you're doing at the moment. This is interesting. Martin, can you tell me about this? Have you used it, or how did you hear about Franz?
I used it for a while when there was part of us using Zoom and Slack, and then I had also Microsoft Office and Gmail. So I used this, but now we are back to Slack only. So, but in the past, I was happy with this one.
Okay. That's cool. I will have to check this out. See, next announcement, or was there anything else on that? No. Okay. Next announcement. Public service announcement here. It's affected every customer we have, and probably some that we don't know about. If you're using GitHub Actions and they started failing with GitHub OIDC for some reason, sporadically and randomly, frustratingly, it's probably because only one of the two thumbprints was authorized to work with Actions. So just adding the other one fixes it. If you do use our Terraform component for that, we also upstreamed a pull request that fixed that last night. Just upgrade the component and it should start working for you. GitHub had they don't post what the error message is, but you'll know if you have it. here's something somebody can fill me in on. I don't know how I missed such a significant part of Terraform 1.5's announcements. I think because when I saw import, I was, okay, yeah, I know about import, moving on. There's a actual import block now within HCL that will, and this is the part I was a little bit confused. It says Terraform produces HCL to act as a template that contains Terraform's best guess at the appropriate value for each resource argument. Is this like a ephemeral resource that it generates like at runtime? It doesn't sound like it actually writes it to disk, but I'm confused about this and how this works. And if it is writing it to disk, how in the world that would work in a GitOps methodology? Please, somebody, nobody.
There was a Terra something project that did this before.
Yeah, Terraformer. Like at least one other one. Terraformer was by Google. Microsoft came out with one that was impossible to remember the name of. I think they were going to rename it, but this is now some kind of native support for importing the actual resource construct. Oh, Mike Percival shares. Yeah, the other one was called Terra Cognito. I think that was the one by at Microsoft.
I think this makes Terraform infinitely more implementable if you already have infrastructure.
Oh, Cyclidio is the Terra Cognita. So I got that one wrong. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the argument they make in this announcement, if I can find my tab again. But yeah, it solves a big problem, especially for shops that don't have the privilege of starting fresh, right? We, as a company, really don't like to work in place with existing resources deployed by ClickOps, but yeah. All right. Next announcement, something I saw in the weekly TF newsletter. It's another wrapper for Terraform, an orchestrator suited for monorepos. So similar to Atmos, presumably in that sense. Haven't looked at it, but yeah, they have their own opinionated way of organizing your infrastructure. And looks like they adopted HCL as the configuration language as well for it. So similar, therefore, to Terra Grunt, Terra Mate, and now Terra Scope. Lastly, something I saw immediately before office hours was a post by OpenAI on scaling Kubernetes to 7,500 nodes. These are always fun to learn about the challenges they ran into at certain scales when things break that you didn't realize would break. We'll share more maybe if I get a chance to dig into that. So I wanted to get to this question by somebody I know on the call here, Martin. let's see. I don't know if we have some of the folks that have been regulars on talking about compliance here.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't know how
to. Sean Roberts might know the answer to one of these. He's been, I think, pretty vocal. Let me read the question. Anyone have experience with audit logging and anomaly detection on EKS? Who is willing to share their experience? And anything else you want to add to that, Martin?
I mean, it's hard to formulate it in one question, right? Yeah. So we have this problem. We want to get SOC 2 compliance. And they basically say, yeah, you have to have an automated way to analyze your logs and to find anomalies for vulnerabilities and so on, intruder detection.
And well, SOC 2 wouldn't say that, would it? Because it's just an audit framework.
Right? What they just said, though, is conflicting with their statement. So vulnerabilities are vulnerabilities, not anomalies. They are vulnerabilities. So
but you have to start somewhere. So,
what I'm saying is, yeah, as long as they're not saying an anomaly is a vulnerability. In general, when people say anomaly detection, they, for the most part, they don't know what they're talking about. my experience.
I agree with you. It's the same. What is a correlation and a causality? Okay, but let me start fresh. Okay, we should prove that we have some automated way to detect vulnerabilities on our log files for the application and for our infrastructure. And of course, the CloudWatch has everything in, is available in Amazon, and we have Datadog for all the other log management. And I wanted to activate the SIEM stuff in Datadog to do it, and therefore transfer the relevant logs to Datadog. And I started with it, and it turned out this is a pretty expensive way to do it because of all paying the traffic, paying Datadog. Whoever started with it knows the stuff. And so I started rethinking if this is the right track, and yeah, I don't know who to talk to and share some experience and ideas about this stuff.
I don't know an open source vendor or like an open source, completely open source product that has there's plenty that have the ability, but ones that have the rules are the hard part. And that's what Datadog is saying, or they have automatic rules for certain things.
Yeah, they already have a bunch of rules, right? But it's the same as for GuardDuty on Amazon. They have probably same rules.
Same thing for Splunk. They have some rules. So you have to see if there's a vendor that fits in inside your cost. And then if you find a way to do it without paying a vendor tons of money or spending or dedicating someone's job to writing rules, I'd love to hear it.
Wazoo. What, Brian?
I was saying we actually use Wazoo. That's what he's looking at right now.
Okay.
I'll share it in the chat.
It does quite a bit. Because we had the same problem when looking at the Cloud Seam. Because you pay the agent host, and then you got the Cloud Seam, which is like it was double the cost. So you're paying like $30 per host to do the Cloud Seam, and it, like you said, Datadog side it does a really good job, but it's just extremely costly.
Yeah,
exactly. I wouldn't mind per host. The Datadog is per data amount, which that's
well.
And they both. They have different things. You some parts you pay for host. And some you pay per gigabyte log, and some you pay per number of events.
Yep.
So if you enable all, you are around at $30 per host.
And that's where it gets ridiculous, in my opinion, for Datadog. Mm. We're avid users of Datadog as well. And like I said, their anomaly stuff is really good. The cloud security stuff's really good. But we on the FedRAMP side, we were doing everything pretty much inside of AWS for the most part. And trying to use most of the AWS tools with Detective, GuardDuty, and things like that, trying to keep up on the security side.
Yeah. And has someone tried this tool called GuardDuty?
We've used GuardDuty. Yeah.
And are you happy with it? Is it okay? Is it sufficient?
Yeah. I mean, it does a really good job as finding stuff while it's happening and different attacks. And that's built into AWS.
Exactly, and you can transfer or forward the logs to Datadog and then react there.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and some of the ways that Datadog recommends to on the log side is keep your ingestion way down, so that keep your hot storage down to like maybe 7 days, and then use their built-in archiver to archive all your active logs off to S3. And because chances are, if something's happening, you're going to catch it when it's happening. But if you need to go back and look at something, you can always rehydrate. So that way, you're not keeping all your logs into hot storage where it's extremely costly.
It makes sense.
Like a week's worth in there, and then archive the rest of it to S3, and then rehydrate whenever needed. And that'll cut down costs quite a bit.
Yeah, the other cost thing that got us is we have our own logging platform, so we don't really use CloudWatch directly, but all of our logs are being funneled through CloudWatch. Some have to be by default, but like all our container logs we chose to do that because it was easy. But then we were paying for the logs going through CloudWatch, which we're not even querying, and then again paying for the place we were landing them. So we changed that model to not go for anything that doesn't have to. It doesn't go to CloudWatch, so they're not paying. At one point, that was like 70% of our entire budget, just CloudWatch alone.
We were sending a lot of stuff to OpenSearch using Kinesis Firehose to split it.
Yeah,
and so we're using TD Agent to send a lot of the logs to Firehose, and then Firehose send them to S3 automatically and to the Elasticsearch.
We have a similar pattern now. Yeah. So, and that reduced our cloud budget for some of our control planes by like 60%.
Yeah, and then that footage. And then you can utilize the stuff inside of OpenSearch to do all your anomaly detection, things like that as well. Uh-huh. Newer version, they've got quite a bit. They got a decent security package with it too.
Can you post those names just in the chat so that I can remember?
Yeah.
Would be cool. Yeah. And John, how can I bypass CloudWatch?
Well, it depends what it is. If you're talking the pure EKS logs themselves, not your container logs, or the default one that's there, that one you can't right now. However, when I last met a couple months ago with the EKS product managers, they did say that they are working on so you can write directly to S3 instead, because some people want S3 as their or Kinesis. They want that as their processing, right? They don't like that some services can write Kinesis and some can't. So they are going to change that. But right now, that has to go to CloudWatch. However, for us, that's tiny compared to our container logs. And container logs, you have to set up yourself. It's not on by default. You either use a CloudWatch agent, TD agent, FluentBit, whatever. That's the one that we shifted to bypass and not use CloudWatch as the place, because it didn't have to go there.
Yeah, and that's what we did too. We used FluentBit and TD agent to send to Kinesis.
Yeah, Evan, this is also what I'm thinking. I mean, having the checkmark is easy by enabling SIEM on some data, then RADA is happy, or our compliance partner. But from an SRE perspective, I want to do it right.
Yeah, and then the built-in stuff with AWS, if everything is in AWS and it's on EC2 instances, then they have really good cloud security, cloud posturing as far as vulnerability scanning, CIS compliance and things like that. If not, then Wazoo is a good one to use. It'll scan all your hosts, find vulnerabilities, and you can report on that as well.
Mm. Okay. Well, I think I have some stuff to read.
Yeah. And then with Wazoo, there's a ways you can actually, like you can take all your VPC flow logs, CloudTrail, config logs and all that, import them into Wazoo, and then actually process those with Wazoo and get a dashboard as well. Wazoo now uses, so they've forked OpenSearch and they've forked Kibana. So they have the Wazoo indexer and then they have their own Wazoo dashboard.
Why did they need to fork?
So what?
Do you know why they needed to fork?
I don't know why they actually forked it. Just everyone knows, Wazoo itself is a fork of OSSEC.
Oh.
And so they forked from that and created Wazoo. And so they have a really good support. If you actually pay for the support, they're very responsive, very good to work with. And then I don't know why they actually ended up forking from OpenSearch and Kibana, other than I think they did it just for like maybe their branding and things like that. Because they're changing up dashboards and things and some stuff, just trying to make it a little bit better.
Well, there were also license changes.
Yeah, so. I think a lot of that probably had to do with more licensing too.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Last year, Amazon had to do some stuff with Elastic's license.
Yep, that's when they came out with OpenSearch.
Yeah,
yeah, because of Elastic.
And I hadn't heard about this. Someone shared a TD agent, Brian Polly. What is? How is that different, like from Fluent? Bit.
It's all the same owner, same people.
Okay.
Just different flavor versions of it, different lightweight. And...
Okay. So no association with this Treasure Data company.
Well, Treasure Data is FluentD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they are.
But FluentD is a beast. So unless you have to use FluentBit, not FluentD. Even the maintainer will tell you use FluentBit, right. Not FluentD. You absolutely have.
You can kind of scale it up as you need it. But it gives you the ability to send data a lot of different ways, which is great.
So FluentD is the original one that was in like Ruby or something. Yep. FluentBit was the one rewritten in like C or something. And TD client, is that rewritten in Go or is that still in Python or Ruby or something?
I think there's different versions of it.
Oh, interesting. Oh yeah, TD client, Ruby, TD client, Go. Okay. All right. Anyone have anything else more to add to that before we get to another question? Did you have a follow-up question on that one, Martin?
Well, I had the thread, so I was wondering why I cannot configure the audit log in the EKS clusters. And there is an ongoing thread from 2018 that says, yeah, it's not possible with MSN. And is it right? I mean, that I can, for example, just say, don't log things from this particular service because we trust it.
My assumption is that it's on the control plane, and that's why they're not exposing that level of granularity or configuration, but I don't know.
Yeah, because like 30% of the cluster logs or audit logs are Carpenter things, I think.
And... well, Carpenter verbosity can be reduced. Have we looked...
Is no, it... not yet. I just wanted. I mean, I know that you can, if you have your own Kubernetes cluster, then you can write this audit config, and you can say, don't log for Carpenter or don't log for this service. Mm-hmm. But I haven't found this option in EKS.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that question. Thanks everyone for helping answer it. Any other questions we can get answered today? I have no more announcements. I got nothing else. So I rely on you guys for Q&A material. Any questions? Did we discuss number four?
I'm just curious about what...
Oh, I think I did skip that one. Sorry. Yeah, go on.
Oh, I'm just curious about what you consider to be a good workflow for reviewing and testing deployments of Terraform code. I'm just a student. I was just curious. I see your modules on the registry, and I thought it'd be an interesting opportunity to ask someone who works with Terraform every day.
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer the question first, though. Anyone else want to take this one first before I chime in? All right, so testing and Terraform. Big question, of course. I'll try and break it in half. So first thing to get clear is that you have two different types of Terraform modules when you're using Terraform at any reasonable scale. So the first one is the one that everyone's familiar with, like you see on my screen, our EFS backup module, null label, AWS NLB, and so forth. The other thing that you'll probably have doing Terraform at scale are root modules. We call them components. And we call them components because ours are opinionated in a way that we like them to work. And components are slightly different. Components have Terraform state. They call child modules, and they're often what you are deploying in your environments. So the easiest thing in the world to test are probably regular Terraform modules themselves. And there's pretty much one de facto tool out there that rules them all at this stage. And that is something called, what am I looking at here? Why, of all the things I pull up, why am I pulling up something that doesn't have a test folder? I don't know about that. Nena, can you... Or Jeremy, can you remind me to look into that, why that repo is missing tests? None of our repos should miss tests. All right, so here's a NLB component, a module. This module was actually contributed by an open source community member. Somebody created this based on some of our other modules. So Terraform has some basic testing built in, but it's not really what's gonna help you manage infrastructure at scale. And for that, the tool is TerraTest. TerraTest is by a company called Gruntwork. They built it to test their own infrastructure. And while it's called TerraTest, implying that it's only for Terraform, it's really a generic infrastructure test framework built in Go that allows you to call commands, verify the output, and ensure that, you know, things function as you would expect. And it can do that in parallel, and it can help you clean up afterwards and so forth. So testing on Terraform is, you know, in an ideal world, you would have test coverage that is thorough on everything that your module is provisioning, with exception of the underlying resources. For example, Terraform itself has tests, testing like when you use a bucket resource, you should get a bucket. It would be stupid in your Terraform testing, in my opinion, to retest or validate that after calling a module that you got a bucket, because you're just duplicating test functionality at the core. Instead, verifying that your Terraform code delivers on the use case that it's trying to solve. That said, that is still a lot to ask for an open source community to contribute all those tests and so forth. So currently our bar, our minimum standard, follows the Pareto 80-20 principle. If you can plan a module, and you can apply a module, and you can destroy a module, it catches 80% of the bugs, except for not the 20% that you're going to pay for later on when you wish you had tests for those. And what we do in those cases is we add those case by case when we run into them to try and catch those. So the reason why it's so important to test on Terraform modules, plan, apply, and destroy, is very frequently plan and apply work, but changes to the code break destroy. And we've run into that so often in something else that we do, which are our Terraform root modules. That's probably a perfect segue to the next type of testing to get into. But before I do, any questions on more specific questions just on testing modules?
Well, I'm super curious how, let's say you wanted to test that a bucket had a certain policy associated with it. And I've got to teach myself how this tool, TerraTest, and see how would I pull that information? Is that a data block? Is that a TerraTest test in their library?
So Go? It'd be written in Go. And that is the barrier to entry in testing, and why so few open source modules and module creators actually have tests. Is it raises the bar considerably, going from just, I can write HCL to, I can write Golang, and I know how to test and validate all these things. And they can get pretty hairy. The problem is that it is actually hairy. There's a lot that you need in order to thoroughly validate something in AWS does what you want it to do. And in some cases, you know, for example, TerraTest was written, TerraTest can SSH into a box and verify that certain files exist and certain processes are running and so forth. So I see it more like it's a progression in your journey towards infrastructure as code and as an organization. You're not going to pull it off in the beginning, but look, you got enough things to, enough fires to fight to worry about it. Vlad points out, in his opinion, most Terraform testing either does not make sense or is not worth it. So, here's where it does make sense. So I think there's in different contexts, like use cases. So, you know, Cloud Posse, we're a relatively small company, right? And we maintain 500 plus repositories, 200 are for Terraform. And we could not conceivably accept any third-party pull requests if we didn't at least verify that they plan and apply and destroy, because it is so frequent that developers overestimate how often their minor one character change, this is not going to break anything. This is just what, you know, it's supposed to be. And sure as shit, it doesn't work. So we started to scale when we had tests. We did not scale before that. It was literally our, like, we're talking, we're going back to like 2018 at this point. But in 2018, that's what we'd have to do as maintainers. We check out your pull request. We try and plan it in between, you know, 10 other projects and see that it works. And that doesn't work. So at a company now, are you a one-man shop? I agree entirely with Vlad. Are you a two-man shop? Still probably no problem. Are you a 15-person, 20-person, 30-person shop contributing to the same code base that happens to be infrastructure as code? Well, if you have GitOps, which I'll get to next, that can maybe fulfill the need for testing for right now until you have more thorough tests. So GitOps. So the next challenge that we have is our Terraform root modules. This gets more complicated pretty quickly. So, well, let me jump back a little bit here. So modules are pretty nice because a well-built module does one thing pretty well, but the scope is limited. They tend to operate within one AWS account. They tend to have minimal feature flags. Now, this is not true of all modules. You'll see modules out there with 200, 300 variable inputs. And guess what? Those are also the same modules that have zero tests. And there's a very popular organization out there with modules like that. Okay, rant aside. What you do in the case of an NLB, when we look at the tests and we look at the examples, is we have to do a few things here. How do you test an NLB if you don't have a VPC, if you don't have subnets? So as part of your test, you have to have an example that both provisions the underlying infrastructure that you need to test that module that you built. In this case, just testing ourselves, ... but we provisioned a basic VPC for that test. All right. Let's keep that in mind now as we go over to Terraform AWS components. These are our Terraform root modules. These are also public and open source. They comprise our reference architecture. Components are a whole lot more opinionated than just a child module. And in our opinion, the best components are also pretty limited in scope. You'll see at a lot of companies that they'll combine the VPC with the EKS cluster, with the Redis database, with the RDS Aurora cluster. And that's just the first month. And then every month they're adding to that root module. And it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until that root module has also 100 inputs, like those modules I said that were bad, and is very slow to plan. It takes 45 minutes to an hour to run a Terraform plan on it. Imagine when your automated tests then would take that long. It's very slow to iterate and it's an anti-pattern. Okay, so we don't do that. We break it apart. So we have one root module for a VPC. We have one root module for a transit gateway, one for SFTP, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we have another problem. If we break our infrastructure apart like this, how do we test EKS when we don't have a VPC, because the VPC is a different life cycle from the EKS. So now we get into a composite problem of testing components that need to work together as a system. And that's a lot more costly to test, a lot more time consuming to test in a traditional sense using something like TerraTest. And for now, I admit we don't test them that way. So how do you, this gets me back to that problem of GitOps. So GitOps is this concept where you have the desired state of your infrastructure in version control in something like Git or GitHub. And you have automation that runs a Terraform plan as our CI. I put in air quotes, it's not like true CI, but it's a smoke test, a dry run. Produces an artifact, which is your Terraform plan file. And then you do CD. So you take that plan file and you deliver it. You deploy it ultimately to some environments. Now, the first one of those environments is your sandbox or your dev account. And that's how you validate that. Well, in one known configuration, in one account, we verify that this thing works. The problem is, in reality, you have different configurations and different environments and testing all those variable combinations. is costly, time consuming, and skipped by 99% of companies doing Terraform. So my two cents. There is one other thing you can do, by the way, for testing this that helps, which is something that we do and we recommend, that of companies who practice GitOps with Terraform for their root modules that they don't do, is you run the plan in your pull request against all environments. And then you know that it's at least going to work, and you know the blast radius and the impact of making that change in dev, staging, and production. This is why I'm really against the pattern within TerraGrunt and the TerraGrunt community of pinning root modules in dev, staging, and production, because then when you make a change in dev, you are totally with blinders on what's the impact in staging and what the impact is in production until you merge that pull request, and then you get to find out what the surprise is in staging, and then you get to find out what the surprise is in production when you do the version pinning strategy. So this is why what we do in our strategies, both for GitHub Actions, for Spacelift, is view the plan across all environments. All right, that was a long monologue. Any questions from you or anyone else?
No, just thank you for that.
My pleasure.
I mean, you have also customers who are testing this.
Yeah, exactly. And when all of that fails, just, you know, test it with your customers. No, but in all seriousness, this is what also really helps, is the more people that use your code, the more people that are kicking the tires on it, the more battle tested it will be. So, you know, if you are just working in isolation, you don't always get that. All right. Any other questions about this or anything else from anyone? We got another 10 minutes or so on the clock. Oh, Issa was asking about, has anyone tried system initiative in production last week? No, I think it was announced last week. Vlad, you brought it up, I think, and you were very bullish on it. You liked the initial design and construct.
Yeah, I did a Twitter thread on it too. I got to use it in the preview. I talked a bunch with the team. It's super early, like it's not usable now. It was a private preview. Now it's a private beta. They have only a couple of resources, like it's not usable. But they seem to be getting everything right. For every single question or concern I had, they had a very, very good plan for how to tackle that. They knew where the problems were. They had the right team of people to do it. Like they have ex-Plumi people, ex-HashiCorp people. I am very hopeful about its future. I praise them a bunch more on Twitter. I can link through the thread. But yeah, it looks awesome. It's not really usable already right now, but add it to the top of your to watch list. And yeah, also my quote is on their website.
So disclosure. Yeah,
there it is. I'm truly an influencer now. Yay.
Yeah. Life's mission complete.
Hey, Eric, I wanted to, is it okay if I ask a question?
Yeah, please go ahead.
I know last week we had kind of touched on, you know, best practices around versioning modules. So we have like modules that are referencing other modules, and they all have, you know, a versions.tf file that have basically the required version for all these things. But in a lot of cases, you know, we're combining these things from different places, and every once in a while we run into these like issues where, you know, upgrading this one module breaks that one, but we need a newer version for this other one. I was trying to find just like some kind of like best practice guide around like, this is the tried and true way of like how to use versions.tf across all of your parent, child, and root modules. I was just curious if you could point me to anything or like wanted to briefly talk about how you guys handle that.
Yeah, I can talk about our lessons learned the hard way. Now, this was a number of years ago, and we ate wholesale or subscribed to wholesale the whole you need to strictly version pin your modules as precisely as makes sense within your